Thank you. And thank you for inviting me over to PI. I've been having a great week as usual. And I'm going to tell you a bit about my most recent work, which is together with John Barrett. And it's on the archive. I'm actually not sure. We submitted it for publication. I think it's still under review. But the idea is random non-commutative geometry. So non-commutative geometry and the non-commutative geometries that we want to think about that we have used so far are fuzzy spaces. Fuzzy spaces are a special class of non-commutative geometry, and I'll explain them a little bit more in de later. But now I wanted to give you a big picture. I mean, why are we interested in fuzzy spaces and in non-commutative spaces? And certainly the best reason to be interested in that are actually Alan Kohn's results, where he managed to get the whole standard model out of non-commutative geometry. If you try to describe electrodynamics in non-commutativity, then you get the rest of the standard model out for free. And with a slight tweak, you even get neutrino masses of approximately the right order. So it's very interesting that you get so many things of the symmetries out of a very mathematical construction. Another thing that non-commutative geometry can do for us is it can discretize a geometry. It can describe a geometry in terms of its spectrum, and it can set a cutoff on the highest frequencies that are allowed in the spectrum. That is a fuzzy sphere construction. So we can describe all particles, and we can discretize space. So maybe that can go together somehow. And the idea that John and I have started to look at is to use discretized geometries as fuzzy spaces as a regularization for the path integral. Can we calculate a path integral on fuzzy spaces? So an integral over fuzzy spaces. And the way we're doing that is with Monte Carlo simulations, because that's what I do. One very speculative idea that we also have, which we will explore eventually, is to maybe use fuzzy spaces to actually model other systems. Not use a fuzzy space to model gravity, but maybe make it such a well-developed method that you can give it to an engineer and he can model his newest waveguide as a fuzzy space, because that should work better than just a normal regularization. Because after all, fuzzy space is built on the waves, so it's gonna be a better approximation than straight lines. So all of that, I think, makes very good reasons to start thinking about fuzzy space, apart from all the pretty math that is hiding behind it. And the question, why are we doing random fuzzy space? Well, we want to do quantum gravity. We want to take a path integral over geometries, which is certainly the first starting point for quantum gravity. Of course, we can't be sure yet. The things we are summing over, probably not all of them are manifold-like. It's not even so simple to get out which dimension if the things are manifold-like, but it's interesting to look at. It's a good starting point. To give this a perspective, we've started thinking about that less than a year ago. We've already done some simulations now. We've got interesting results. We have something that looks as if it gives us something two-dimensional. And that's two people working for less than a year. So I think there's a lot of potential to go further and grow further in this direction. And of course, the idea to use a path integral to solve quantum gravity, to take a path integral over geometries and discretize that somehow, is something that's inspired by many other approaches like CDTs, spin foams, causal sets. So that is the motivation for my talk today. The outline for what I'm going to talk about, the first thing is I'll give you a very crashy crash course in fuzzy space. I'll explain the spectral triple and how a fuzzy space looks and how the Dirac algebra on the fuzzy space looks. And then I'll talk a little bit about properties of the spectrum that are intrinsic to the fuzzy space, where what we've done with the Dirac does not really show up yet. And I'll show you the construction of the fuzzy sphere. First, the Gross-Prisnyder fuzzy sphere, which is the most common one, and then a more recent construction by John, which has some advantages and which kind of was the starting point from where we were thinking. And then I'm going to talk about the Monte Carlo simulations that we've implemented, and I'll tell you about our results in one for one-dimensional fuzzy spaces. For two-dimensional, I didn't make it a subpoint, but we also have some three-dimensional ones. And then I'll talk about the phase transition. And in the end, I'll have a conclusion, and at the very end, a short video, if it works. So first up, fuzzy space. So what everybody talks about in non-commutative geometry, well, I shouldn't say everybody in non-commutative geometry, because there's different versions of non-commutative geometry. But if you're doing non-commutative geometry the Kohn's way, then you talk about spectral triples. A spectral triple, strictly speaking, the triple is a Hilbert space H, an algebra A, and a Dirac operator D. But if you want to do interesting stuff with it, you usually also get out a signature S and a chirality operator gamma and a real structure J. So a chirality operator takes particles to antiparticles, sort of. The real structure is something like a complex conjugation. It allows you to get real results. And the signature is just a property of the space, a property of the Hilbert space. So if you have a spectral triple like this, a simple example of that would be actually a classical 1-3 geometry. That is then a commutative spectral triple. The Hilbert space is all functions on the manifold with the LT spinors. The algebra is the algebra of all smooth functions on the manifold. The Dirac operator is just the usual differential operator that we've all learned in quantum mechanics. The signature is defined as Q minus P, so it comes from the spinor space, and in this case it's 2. We've got a chirality as the gamma 5 chirality matrix, and we've got the charge conjugation as a real structure. So that's the abstract things that make up a spectral triple and how it is in a classical 1-3 geometry. Now, what we want to look at actually is not the most general case. We want to look at fuzzy geometries, which are slightly simpler than the most general construction. In fuzzy geometries, our Hilbert space is a product space. It consists of a Clifford algebra, which is where our spinors will live. And then we have n by n matrices if it's a field of all complex matrices. The algebra acting on this is the algebra of all complex matrices, which then acts on the Hilbert space in the natural way. The signature is defined from the Clifford module as Q minus P mod 8. And the chirality is the chirality operator from the Clifford module, just acting on the Clifford module, nothing happening to the matrix space. And the real structure is charge conjugation on the Clifford module and a complex conjugation and a transposition on the matrix, so the adjoint operation on the matrices. This is the most general definition for fuzzy geometry. And there's one thing that I haven't talked about here is the Dirac operator. And that's because that's my next slide. So in the most general case, you can write this Dirac operator. The Dirac operator is acting on our element of the Hilbert space. It's V tensored with a matrix, V a Clifford module element. And it's acting by so we can decompose it as omega. Omega is a product of gamma matrices acting on V. And then that is tensored with K, K being a complex matrix acting on the matrix we want to act on with our Dirac operator. And K is first acting, the first term, that's the left action of K. And the second term, we are acting from the right with the adjoint of K. The factor epsilon prime has to do with the real structure on our space and is plus or minus 1. This real structure is connected to the signature of our Clifford algebra again. But it's plus or minus 1. We can because the Dirac operator has to be real operator, so it should be self-adjoint. We need to require that if our product of gamma matrices is self-adjoint, then K should be self-adjoint, K should be Hermitian, and if omega is anti-Hermitian, then K also needs to be anti-Hermitian. A simple example of this is for a 1-1 geometry. So you have two gamma matrices, one which squares to minus one, one which squares to one. Gamma one squares to one, gamma two squares to minus one. So gamma one is Hermitian, gamma two is anti-Hermitian. And then because H is Hermitian and L is anti-Hermitian, we can write it as commutators and anti-commutators. So the Dirac operator is acting with the gamma matrix and then commutator of H plus gamma matrix times anti-commutator of L. And we can always decompose the Dirac operator on a fuzzy space into these H and L matrices, which make it up. So because L is only acting in a commutator, the trace of L actually decouples and only the traceless part is physical, which means that we don't need to worry about the trace of L in our simulation. So the algebra, as I already promised, the algebra has interesting influence on what happens with the spectrum of our operator. So if the signature is even, then we have a chirality operator. And for even signatures, the chirality operator is non-trivial, which means it has eigenvalues plus one and minus one. And then because the chirality operator anti-commutes with the Dirac operator, we find that every eigenvalue lambda has a mirrored eigenvalue minus lambda. So the spectrum will always be even if we have a the spectrum will always be symmetric if we have even signature. Also, if the real structure is non-trivial with eigenvalues plus minus one for one and five, in this case, the real structure does the same thing as the gamma matrix did before, as the chirality did before, and leads to a symmetric spectrum. On the other hand, if we have a non-trivial real structure and a non-trivial chirality, no, so if the real structure commutes with the Dirac operator, then we find that we have a spectrum with eigenvalue doubling. And that is because J and D commute, but J and D commute, but if we want to take J through a complex number, then that complex number gets complex conjugated. So if V is an eigenvector of the Dirac operator with eigenvalue lambda, then JV is also, well, then JV is also an eigenvalue of the Dirac operator lambda. But JV and V cannot be the same because if we act with J squared is minus one. If we act with J squared on V, we can act with J on V. And if we act on J and V, and that's linear to V, so complex number times V, then well, we can act on it again and we find a contradiction. So we have a doubling of eigenvalues. And so we found that the spectrum doubles for two, three, and four, and that the spectrum is symmetric for all even numbers and one and five. So just this tells us already some things about the spectrum. Now, the next thing is we can look at the fuzzy sphere. So, Gross-Priestschneider operator is a construction of a Dirac operator for the fuzzy sphere. It's constructed with the fuzzy sphere as a type 0-3 geometry. So it has codimension 3. If you have a normal classical sphere, that has codimension 2. It's a simple two-dimensional space. So it's a bit weird that we have 0-3 and then how this should, in the limit of our spectrum going to infinity, turn into two is a bit odd. So the Dirac operator is defined as one plus the sigma here are the Pauli matrices tensored with commutator of angular momentum generators. And the spectrum for the Grosse Prosnida fuzzy sphere looks as on that picture. What you can see is, so the eigenvalues are linearly rising. That's nice. Linear spectrum means two-dimensional. That is exactly what we'd want. The normal sphere would do this linear rising in discrete steps up to infinity. But of course, it's a discretization, so the spectrum gets cut up at some point, and the cutoff is around n, so for an n by n matrix. But here, what we see is the spectrum is not symmetric. Actually, we have, on one side, we have half as many eigenvalues as the next step would be, while on the other side, we have nothing happening. So this is a bit weird. Now, John constructed an approximation for the fuzzy sphere, which has, so yeah, s equals 3 is weird and it's non-symmetric. John has constructed an approximation for the fuzzy sphere, which has codimension 2. And that is, of course, much nicer because it matches the fuzzy sphere that we know. It matches with the normal sphere, and the spectrum is symmetric. We still have a kind of cutoff effect that at n, our spectrum does not keep growing as it should, but we kind of have only half as many values. And what happens in the fuzzy sphere discretized like this is that because we have s equal 2 now, we get an eigenvalue doubling. There is no way to get around that. S equal 2 will always include eigenvalue doubling, so a kind of fermion doubling. So, and probability of eigenvalue lambda. That's just, you can think of this as the number of eigenvalues, or you can think of it as the probability for the eigenvalue if I have normalized. I'm just, no, this is actually an exact result. This is an exact result. I'm just going to use the exactly same type of histogram later for my simulations. And that's why I'm labeling it with the probability and not with the number. So in this case, it's not really a probability. Later, it will be a probability distribution of eigenvalues. Because what we're doing in the random geometries is, of course, we're averaging over very many simulations. And this averaging gives us a probability density for the eigenvalues. Yes, here we have the eigenvalue 1 appears twice, and 2 appears 4 times, and so forth. Yes, there's a degeneracy. There's, on the one hand, the doubling, which is implicit because s equal 2. And then all higher eigenvalues are degenerate, just as you would expect for the sphere. I mean, the number of eigenvalues, that's the m modes, basically. You go from minus m to plus m. A 10 by 10 dimensional matrix, yeah. I mean, it can, depending on, so which matrix it acts on, depends, of course, on which representation I choose for the LJK. So that's just a n-dimensional representation of the spheric, of the Lie group for SU2. So, in the limit of this being an infinite dimensional representation, we will get back to the sphere. That's the idea.
I think I got lost with the notation. This 1-3 sounds like it means Minkowski space or something, a four-dimensional space. But you say that the sphere has co-dimensions too, so where do we see that it's not the whole space?
So it's a bit confusing. I've been thinking about this a lot, how it makes sense. But so the 1-3 is the space of spinners. But the space of spinners is not directly the same as the space of your manifold. Which dimension your manifold is, you have to read off from the Dirac operator and the spectrum somehow. So we can have higher dimensional spinners.
The spinners are the ones that would be suitable.
Yes.
Is that the statement?
I think, yes. So we have, at least we have four gamma matrices.
We have four
That's
gamma
really what
matrices.
it tells us. It tells us that the spinor space has one
One
Hermitian.
square is to minus one and the other three square. Or plus
One
one.
one
Or
square
actually
to
minus
one,
one.
three square to minus one,
Three square
but
to minus one.
yeah, that's really all that we can say about it.
So naively you would have expected two, but
Somehow, if
somehow
you want
four is better.
yeah, you if you want to construct the fuzzy sphere, and you would think I start out with a 0-2 geometry because that's what I think I should get, and that doesn't work. There's actually a reason why you cannot construct a fuzzy sphere in 0-2. And I can show you that later when I have the appropriate spectrum. Remind me of it. I can go into detail why that doesn't work the way. So these were two simple examples of fuzzy space. Now, of course, comes the really interesting part of my talk, the random fuzzy spaces, in which we use Monte Carlo simulation to explore the space of Dirac operators. The logic being that if you have a non-commutative space, the fermions are part of your Hilbert space with the Clifford algebra, but the all gauge fields are part of the Dirac operator. And so gravity should also be part of your Dirac operator. And so what we try to do is do a path integral over the Dirac operator. And we need to measure some function f. So we want to integrate over the Dirac operator d. And as I showed you, we can decompose the Dirac operator for any given type into a number of h and l matrices, which are smaller. So what we are really integrating over are the h and l, but the h and l maps the space of all Dirac operators. It's just a convenient parameterization. Because the restrictions we have on H and L is just that they need to be Hermitian or anti-Hermitian, but the Dirac operator itself has a whole bunch of restrictions because it needs to have a certain behavior with regard to the chirality and the real structure and be self-adjoint and a lot of different things. We
So you have operators H and L, and so one of them is Hermitian, the other one anti-Hermitian. Is
Yes.
it like that one corresponds in the continuum to a derivative in time and the other one in space?
No, not quite.
Rather than.
No, it's so it's this is work that's not quite finished, but what John is looking at now looks like the Hermitian operators become multiplication by a function, while the anti-Hermitian operators become all derivatives. And we don't only have one H and L, we can have several H and L, depending on how many H and L we need, how many different products of gamma matrices there are that become part of our space. We need to choose an action S when doing the path integral. So we need to think about that. What is the best action? And we need some functions of geometry that we can measure. The easiest thing to think about in this case, it's the non-commutative geometry. You also call it a spectral geometry. So we can measure the spectrum of the Dirac operator, and that is almost exclusively what we've done. There's very few cases where something other than the spectrum of the Dirac operator makes any sense. So the action that we choose to use is the simplest possible we could think of. We're just taking the trace of the Dirac operator squared times the plus the trace of the Dirac operator to the power of 4 with two prefactors. And it turns out that if we have both traces, we can actually scale away one of the two factors by rescaling the Dirac operator. So we can set G4 to 1 and only look at G2, only vary G2. And then everything else can happen through a rescaling of the Dirac operator. So we don't need to explore the whole two parameter space. We have a one parameter space, basically. The physical motivation for this action, well, it's the simplest order. I mean, if you are in a deep enough minimum, you'll usually find something that looks similar to this. Because
if you put this here and like down here, then you get everything.
Okay. We actually haven't thought of doing that. That's a very good idea. Sorry. And another thing that's very important for this action, if we pick the G2 factors right, we can always have it bounded from below. The reason why we really need to insist on our action being bounded from below is that if we don't bound it from below, the Monte Carlo simulations will just fall into the infinite well and no result will ever make sense. It'll just keep walking down in the Dirac operator, the eigenvalues will all become more and more negative, and there's nothing interesting about that. There's some other actions that are very popular and that one could have considered, but that we didn't. The first is the Cohn-Shamsuddin action. This is actually future work. We need to look into what that does to our random geometries. So the Cohn-Shamsuddin action is just the trace of chi d, and chi is extremely general. Chi is just some function that has a cutoff for large eigenvalues. So if you're implementing this action at the cutoff for large eigenvalues, you also need to restrict your Hilbert space that nothing for larger eigenvalues, that the Hilbert space doesn't allow larger eigenvalues. If you don't do that naively, then you just run away to large eigenvalues again. And the interesting thing about the Cohn-Shamsuddin action is that it's been shown that if you put the Dirac operator for the standard model in there, then the Cohn-Shamsuddin action, you can actually calculate the action for the whole standard model, including gravity and a cosmological constant out of that. But don't ask me how that works. And no, so if we have chi of just some number x, then what it does is something like this with. The problem is, of course, that then if my eigenvalues go larger, then I have nothing happening from the action. And that means that all the larger eigenvalues actually contribute more than those in the middle. So we need to cut off our Hilbert space so that nothing from there contributes.
Can you remind us what is the physical picture behind this? So we have a two-sphere. So is it like we're doing quantum gravity and Euclidean space-time, which is topologically a two-sphere? And there's also gauge fields in the story, and we're also integrating over them, or and
No.
we're not integrating over the fermions, or what exactly?
Okay. So the two sphere was just a motivational example. What we're doing is we're just integrating over, we have a fixed fermion space and we're integrating over all possible geometries. And we don't know what comes out of that. So all possible Dirac operators.
Is it also all possible gauge fields on all possible
Um,
geometries, or?
so we haven't really put any gauge fields in at the moment.
I thought you said that the gauge fields would just be
The
coded into the Dirac operator anyway.
gauge fields come out of the Dirac operator if you take the Dirac operator for the whole standard model. But the Dirac operators that we're taking are so simple that what they give us is only geometry.
Then one last, you have fermions in it too, but are you not integrating over the fermions, is that right?
The fermions in our model are basically decoupled. The fermion space does not do any. We just, they are background. So the next possible option for an action is to do something which would be slightly GR inspired, because if we look at it from dimensional analysis points, then this d minus 2 term would actually be like a curvature scalar. And d minus 4 would be like the volume for the cosmological constant. The problem with this action is that if the eigenvalues of the Dirac operator go to 0, this action blows up. And unfortunately, we cannot avoid them going to 0. In certain cases, we are guaranteed to have 0 eigenvalues. So We did not look at that, but just went with the simplest thing first. So the very simplest cases that we can look at is the 1,0 and 0,1 geometry. So in this case, we only have one gamma matrix each, and the gamma matrix is 1 in the case of 1,0 and I in the case of 0,1. So I don't really need to write it, and I've taken the liberty to take the I that was here and just rescale it into the H, turning my anti-Hermitian matrix L into a Hermitian matrix H. Then the Dirac operator is just an anti-commutator or commutator. The first thing we can maybe do when we're looking at this is look at the codimension. So the 1,0 case has codimension 7. Codimension 7 is not symmetric and does not have eigenvalue doubling. The 0,1 case has S equal to 1. S equal to 1 means that we are symmetric, but no eigenvalue doubling again. So we should find that in our system. So to actually calculate it, we can't act with our Dirac operator on matrices. Instead, what we're doing is turn our Dirac operator into, we take it into a larger tensor space in which left action and right action are turned together into one bigger matrix. That way, we can look at left and right action of the matrices and expand, put it all together. So that's what we've done here. And we can immediately see from this that the eigenvalues of the Dirac operator in 1,0 and 0,1 are the sum or difference of the eigenvalues of the matrix H. And the action looks like this. This is actually a very interesting action. If we look at it as an action of H, it's almost like the matrix model, almost. The standard matrix model would have this term, and then it would have a trace H term. The problem is that trace H is squared here. The squaring leads to a non-local interaction between the eigenvalues of the matrix model, which makes it a bit more complicated. But for the simplest case, we can still do it analytically. And so these are the eigenvalues of H. And now this is why I'm talking about probability densities. This is for n equal 5 matrices. And the probability density for the eigenvalues follows something that's called the Wigner semicircle law, which is for random matrices. And it's very pretty. And we actually find that for all our Dirac operators, H and L will always follow the Wigner semicircle law if we only have a quadratic action. The eigenvalues of the Dirac operator are more complicated. They are not only the semicircle law, but we need to do a convolution of the semicircle law. So this is the 1,0 case, and the convolution works beautifully. In the 0,1 case, well, there's the convolution, but then there's an additional correction term. The correction term comes from the trace H to the square. And this correction term leads to the middle bit. These lines are not fitted. The lines are one integral that I've written. So we can derive the blue lines completely. So the one-dimensional systems are extremely simple and behave very well. The next question we wanted to ask is about two-dimensional systems. There are three possible two-dimensional systems that we can look at. Now, I'm saying two-dimensional. Again, I mean two-dimensional Clifford algebra, which dimensions the system has, the space-time, that's not necessarily the same. So we can do the 2,0, which is S equal to 6. So it will be symmetric, but no doubling. S equals 0, again, symmetric, no doubling. S equal to 2, symmetric and doubling of eigenvalues. We've got Hermitian and anti-Hermitian matrices, and we can turn it into the action again. But what we find when doing the simulation, that's where the interesting things start showing up. This is the distribution of eigenvalues of the Dirac operator. And it's something that we certainly did not expect. So it gets these shoulders, which are probably an effect of the potential. It's got a central peak in the middle. And this is the 0,2 type, which you would have expected to be the the type that the fuzzy sphere should be of. But the 0,2 type has this gap in the middle, and it's hard to see, but here in the middle, we have zero eigenvalues. And you can actually see that the 0,2 type always has to have these zero eigenvalues, because you have the two anti-Hermitian matrices, and you can actually show that they can be diagonalized. They can't be diagonalized simultaneously, but there's always a class of n matrices that commute with both of them. So a class of n matrices that have eigenvalue 0 under the Dirac operator. And, yeah, oh, sorry, two n matrices that have eigenvalue 0 under the Dirac operator. And 2n because we have eigenvalue doubling. So the next thing we can do is look at the d to the 4 term alone. And, if we add the d to the 4 term alone, nothing much changed. The 1,0,1 now really shows us that there's nothing that makes it be symmetric. In the end, I ran more simulations because over time it'll self-average and turn symmetric. But I thought for presentation purposes, it's instructive to see it doesn't have to be symmetric. It'll fluctuate around it. If I run it longer, it becomes symmetric. And 2,0, our shoulders get more peaked. We still have a peak in the middle. 0,2, also more shoulders, still the same peak in the middle. Then 1D and 2D cases are OK, but how about a three-dimensional one? Well, you can now see that the Dirac operator gets progressively more complicated as you add more dimensions of the Clifford algebra. You find more products of gamma matrices that are allowed, and more products of gamma matrices allowed means also more terms H and I. Sorry, there's a typo. The gamma 0 there shouldn't be a 0. It should be a 1. And this one should be a 1. This is, sorry, I should have checked my slides more. So yes, I have. That comes slightly later in the talk. I've first just looked at the simplest cases. It's nicer if we look at the combined terms for the 1D, 2D, and 3D case at the same time, because we can then compare them with each other. So that's why I'm going to talk about the simplest bit of the 3D term. And that shouldn't take too long. So there's a lot of different 3D Dirac operators, 4 in total. And the reason why I haven't looked at those yet is if we simplify the action, it looks like this. That's for the one case that we have. And So the 3D case is actually very nice. This is run long, but we can still see it's not symmetric. 3D shouldn't be symmetric. What 3D does, which we can't see in this plot, is it has eigenvalue doubling. And so the 3D case just does a very nice, I can actually fit a minus x to the 4 and a minus x to the 2 to these beautifully. So it does behave very close to the potential as the only one of them. The others were all doing weird extra stuff. This one sticks closer to its potential. Now about the action with the yeah, sorry, Rafa.
Somehow 3,0 is not the same as 0,3.
No.
So which one, I mean, is this like saying that one signature for space time, at least for the spinner space, is not the same as putting a minus sign for every signature? Or which signature is which? In other words, when you say 0,3, is that like the metric?
The second one are the minus signs. Spatial directions have a minus sign. This is the mathematician's.
Spatial directions have a minus.
Yeah.
So it's 3. Okay, so like 1,3, our normal space would be 1,3. Three spatial directions.
Yeah. And yes, number. They behave very different as.
Normally we think
Yes, if you look at 2,0 and 0,2, they behave very differently. So
So
it's a
aren't
bit.
there two signatures, one of in the internal spinner space? Yeah, this is just the internal spinner
Yeah,
space.
this is
And
just
then
on the.
the signature on the sphere.
Yeah, I mean, the
Or both?
signature on the sphere, on the
Yeah,
geometry here.
because it's just in Euclidean.
Exactly. The geometries are all Euclidean. I mean, introducing a Lorentzianness here makes everything more complicated because then we need to go from the Hilbert space to a more general construction called a Krein space.
So if the geometry is all Euclidean signature, why do you bother with the Lorentzian signature for the spinners?
So it's. And these spinners don't directly have to do with the geometry yet, like in this.
In the continuum, they do, right? I mean, in the Kahn, the spectral triples and so on, the spinners are living somehow in the tangent bundle of space-time manifold.
Yes, but I think the Clifford module of the space that he's working on is something more complicated than 1,3. I think that's something,
So he's doing Euclidean signature space-time, but the spinner's having a character that matches the Lorentzian or some
no,
other.
the standard model is actually because it's a product space with it's a product space of a smooth manifold with some non-commutative internal space, and this manifold is Lorentzian. The manifold is Lorentzian, but the non-commutative internal space is something else. So, okay. So this is now the action with both terms together, and this is just how the potential looks. And I'm gonna keep the color coding like this. So the red line is G2 equal to -1, and the orange line G2 equal to -5. And we would expect that our potent that something happens if we give it a potential like this, that something changes. And no, our action is entirely potential. I'm just calling the whole action a potential now. And now if we look at our system here, then as G2 becomes more negative, something really clearly happens. We go from something that's around the center to something that's peaked on one side or peaked on both sides. The peaking on both sides here is, of course, happening because our spectrum is forced to be symmetric. The peak on only one side here is actually an effect of that our simulations are finite time. If our simulation, it's a symmetry breaking. So here it actually did tunnel over and simulate on the other side for a little bit. So the opposite side would be just as good a solution. So it's just that if we have one Dirac operator here, it'll be on one side, but the ensemble of random Diracs can probe both sides. Except that we are trapped on one side of the potential and need a very long Monte Carlo time to tunnel to the other side of the potential. But clearly, we have a phase transition happening. Something changes dramatically in our terms, in our distribution of eigenvalues. And if we look at the magnitude of the trace d squared term, then we see there's something happening in the magnitude. There's like this little kink happening. And around the kink, the autocorrelation time of the term goes up. So that indicates that there might well be a real phase transition happening. Of course, to determine the phase transition closer, to find out its order and everything, we need to do more work. We need more simulations and different sizes. So, but what about our other types? So, okay, I mean, here I've shown 1, 0, 2, 0, and 0, 3. I skipped 1, 1 because 1, 1 looks like 2, 0. But now if we look at 0, 1 and 0, 2, well, It changes a bit as it becomes more negative, but actually the change is not that dramatic. There's nothing that changes qualitatively. I mean, it's becoming a little more spread out, it's becoming a little more little wider, but there's nothing that dramatically changes anymore. And also, if we look at the trace D2 term, it's going fairly smooth. The autocorrelation time is wobbling about, doesn't really peak anywhere. So what is happening here? Why does something like that happen? And when we were thinking about it, we actually figured it out. The difference is if we have a Hermitian H term. The L terms are all traceless. Their trace is non-physical. But the H terms have a trace. And this trace develops an expectation value as we go over the phase transition. So as we go from G2 minus 1 to G2 minus 4, what happens is we get an expectation value of the trace of H. In the 2-0 case, we even have two H's that can develop an expectation value. And what they do is they share the expectation value. So in the simulations that I'm showing here, what happened is that one H developed the whole expectation value. That's the red line. The other one developed hardly any. But what is really invariant is the blue line, that's the expectation, that's the square root of the sum of the squared expectation values. And in principle, the green line could be higher up, or the two could interchange place. So it's invariant. We have a rotation between these two matrices that can happen. So, and as we go to the continuum, to the phase transition, something interesting happens. If we compare to the fuzzy sphere, we have this linear rise in number of eigenvalues. A linear rise in the number of eigenvalues is something that indicates two dimensions. That's kind of also what the spectral dimension tells us. The spectral dimension measures how the number of eigenvalue rises. And so if we take the closest geometry above the phase transition, then then that looks fairly linear here. And this is the 2-0 case. Okay, so what is happening here is that we're scaling our system a certain way. So we are not scaling our couplings with n. If we wanted to recover the numbers like here, then we'd need to scale our couplings with n. That's just a choice of rescaling. That's a scaling of the Dirac operator. The size of the matrix. This is n equal 10. So in 2-0, it looks like this. And it's nice and symmetric because our spectrum has to be symmetric. In 1-1, not quite as nice, but still symmetric. And again, we're not very close to the phase transition. Closer to the phase transition, it probably should look nicer. And then if we look at 1-0 and 0-3, they are not forced to be symmetric, so they don't look as nice. They're not symmetric around it. But still, there's some indication that it could be interesting, and we need to look at this closer. And now I'm on the conclusion of my talk. So what is it that... Oh, sorry. These are n equal 10. The largest thing we've consistently done is n equal 15. I've got some very limited results for n equal 35. The problem is, if we say we have m of nc, then the Dirac operator, you remember I showed that I write the Dirac operator to get the left and right action as a tensor with 1 and h. Which means that my Dirac operator is actually an n-squared matrix. Which means that even for moderate n, the size of the Dirac operator rises very quickly, which makes it very hard on the computer to calculate the eigenvalues.
So it acts as the identity on the spin-off space?
No. So this is the identity on the matrices. There's also the spinner space, but so it's of course right, so twice n squared, but the real problem is the n squared growth. And so when we started it out, it was all running on my computer, so we were very limited in size. I'm now setting it all up on the HPC in Nottingham, and we'll have results for larger size. But it seems as if even n equal 15 already shows very, very smooth and nice behavior, and that larger n, of course, everything gets nicer and smoother through self-averaging, but it doesn't really change anything qualitatively. Yes, if we were on the two spheres, it would. Of course, then to make sense of that in the harmonics, you then need to know the size of your sphere to make it into anything physical, which we haven't put in. But yeah, so my conclusion. So what have we done? Well, we've done Monte Carlo simulations of fuzzy geometries. And we looked at the eigenvalue distributions in 1D, 2D, and 3D cases. And we find that we can talk about the eigenvalue density. We can identify some of its features. We can figure out some things that are happening. There's a very interesting phase transition, which we're going to look at closer. And maybe around the phase transition, we have something like a continuum. But of course, this is early work. So there's a very, very long to-do list of things that I want to look at in the future, that I'll look at in the future. I mean, we now have some action, but ideally we'd like an action where we know that classically this action peaks around the two sphere, so that we can then use this action and also do analytic work around it. So again, can we do some perturbative expansion around D0? Maybe we can take our action, find what is the average Dirac operator, put that into the action, and see if we can understand something with perturbative expansions. In the 1-0 and 0-1 case, we showed that it is like random matrix theory. All the other cases are also random matrix theory. It's just very complicated observables on random matrices. But there are people that are interested in complicated observables on random matrices, so I have to talk to them and see if they can help me, or I can help them, or we can help each other. The other thing, right now we're looking at the spectrum. The spectrum tells us some things about the geometry, but are there other things about the geometry that we need to look at? Are there other things we need to understand? How can we recognize what the geometry actually is? And of course, I'd love to have a computer where I can actually take the 96 by 96 dimensional matrices that are necessary for the standard model and some quantum geometry and then run that all together. So, as a last little gimmick, you know, all have heard about the question, can we hear the shape of a drum, about the beginnings of spectral geometry? Or in my case, can we hear the phase transition? Well, sort of. And okay. And I'm sure you all heard where the phase transition happened now. Thank you. Yes, it's not a real problem. It's so the problem was I actually had to do a lot of matrix algebra to get to this action, and this takes about a week. So I decided that we can look at one 3D case and then see what happens, and if it's interesting enough, figure out how to do it. And actually, I've now written a mathematical sheet that simplifies these terms for me and does it for me. But that has only happened now, so it was just reluctance to pay so much time up front for things that might not be interesting. So all of these additional actions will be simulated soon, hopefully.
I don't know. I have not thought much about logical theories.
Were you always using the same representation of the gamma matrices? Always the
yes.
Sort of the defining representation, whatever.
Yeah, we were using the consistent representation, but the representation of the gamma matrices should not really matter.
Well, I thought at some point you told us it did, that you could, in the very beginning there was a choice of representation or something.
Oh, that's not the gamma matrices. That's in the sphere we have the, we're using angular momentum generators as the matrices. Just a sec.
Oh, okay.
So here we have the angular momentum generators. That is, instead of having the class of all matrices, it's only the angular momentum generators. And then the representation, the size of the representation gives us the size of the matrix, gives us how far our spectrum goes.
That's like your choice of N in
exactly.
That'd be a related question to this. I mean, if you're doing 2D gravity, what? I mean, you talked about finding a continuum or not finding a continuum. What exactly did that mean? It seemed like you had a whole range of values of the coupling constant for which you got two dimensional behavior. So, is the question about having local degrees of freedom or having small, you know, question about the nature of the fluctuations of the sphere, or what exactly would you look for? Because we don't even know, at least I don't know exactly what is meant by 2D gravity.
Yeah. So the range of different coupling constant, maybe as a first, that is because having a different Clifford algebra leads to a the phase transition happening at a different point. So if you are looking here, you can see the phase transition for 1,0 happens around -3. For 2,0, it happens at 2.5, while for 0,3, it happens at -4. So that's why there's a range of coupling constants here that shows this behavior. And
were you just showing us at the phase transition when you showed all those histograms? Or
you mean these?
Like these, yeah.
That is the closest one above. So that's the closest one that we know above the point where the phase transition happens.
So if you go a little far from the phase transition,
then it doesn't
you don't
look.
See this linear?
No, then we don't see the linearity.
I see.
And yeah, 2D really means that the spectrum shows some linear behavior because that's what you'd expect on a 2D geometry, the spectrum to be linear. And of course, it only shows 2D linear behavior in a range. And that, of course, makes sense because we'd only see the two-dimensionality up to something where the cutoff then kicks in. It looks almost two-dimensional, and then we can probe the cutoff and weird things happen again.
And what does it look like if you're away from the phase transition?
So here we can see, so in the middle, that's before the phase transition, that looks still like the plots I showed before for D2 alone or D4 alone. It has those characteristics roughly. And then if we get away from the phase transition, what happens is that really the eigenvalues get cozy in the potential. So it just kind of follows the potential, just, yeah, like some bell shape, roughly.
Shouldn't one take an action which is kind of the square of the fluctuation of the thing you want to have, like the positive?
Yes, that would be that would be good if we could do it. The problem is we couldn't figure out how to write down an action that is peaked around the sphere without at the same time inserting the sphere somewhere. I mean,
it would start there. It would actually take the sphere and then we find what the perturbation around the sphere is.
Yeah, the...
And take this as an action to square the terminus.
Yeah, but then you've kind of taking away some of the gate freedom. Okay, I've forgotten what our argument was why we didn't do that, but we talked about it quite a while and we found that it does something that we don't want to our spectrum.
If you have something like in 4D, it would automatically or with high probability lead you to something which gives you four dimensional space. At this point, where you can take any action.
Yeah, it's all of these things are certainly stuff that we should look into, but simplest choice first, and d squared seemed like the very easiest thing to do.
So in the work on dynamical triangulations, not necessarily causal. I think the possibility, different kind of phases were identified, like crumpled phase or branched power. Is it known what pattern of what kind of shape of the spectrum corresponds to those? And if so, is there any connection between what you find away from the phase transition?
So
maybe someone knows, I don't know.
I mean, I think the branched polymer phase, you should find eigenvalues almost linear, almost flat. And the crumpled phase, I think you find a peak around one eigenvalue. I think because that's an in the limit infinite dimensional phase. I mean, the crumpled phase means that the space behaves very high dimensional.
So you had something rather like that. You did have a kind of flat.
You mean this was, you mean the D4?
I don't remember, but just before when you.
You mean this is almost flat?
No, I didn't.
Semicircles are basically flat.
Yeah, but the semicircles are just the H and L, which builds the Dirac, so.
Maybe I'm remembering one. I thought you had either showed or said in words that there was some range of the parameters where the spectrum looked almost flat. That's all. Okay.
Can't remember why. I mean, I might have described this the top of the D4 term here as almost flat.
Maybe.
But
it's as flat as it gets for this cutoff.
Yeah.
Thank you again.